What I'm going to speak to you about today is some aspects of the meaning of the Buddhist robe, the kesa. This has both literal and metaphorical meaning. Literally, we are speaking of all forms of the Buddhist kesa, that is to say, the wagesa of the lay Buddhist who has done the keeping of the precepts retreat, such as our friend here is wearing, the small kesa of the lay minister, such as this, or of the monk, such as I am wearing, the large kesa of the lay minister or the monk, such as you have seen some folks wearing today, and some of the fancy jobs that celebrants sometimes have to wear, the large version of one of these things that I'm wearing at the moment. Metaphorically, because as you will see, the meaning of the kesa is essentially the meaning of commitment to Buddhist training. Metaphorically, what I am speaking of is what does it mean to be a committed Buddhist, okay? So we're going to operate here on two levels of meaning at once. And if you do not happen at the moment to have a physical kesa and yet consider yourself to be committed to Buddhist training, consider yourself to be wearing the kesa of training, all right? The texts that I'm going to work from are bits and pieces of two of the chapters of Great Master Eihei Dogen's Shobogenzo. This is a compilation of the majority, but not all, of his works. These were written in Japan in the 13th century, and Great Master Dogen was essentially the founder of our tradition of Buddhism, Soto Zen, in Japan, having brought it from China. The two chapters that I'm referring to are known as Kesa Kudoku and Den E. Those of you who have translations in the Nishiyama and Stevens version can look them up. The translations I will be working from, however, are preliminary versions of the translations by our Reverend Hubert. And I have the pleasure of working with him on these translations. Not that I am a scholar of medieval Japanese or Chinese language, I'm not. What my role mainly as editor with him is to assist him in taking his scholarly translation and turning it into what I call something comprehensible to the Buddhist lorry driver. I have this Buddhist lorry driver in my mind. It has to be a Buddhist lorry driver, but I have this Buddhist lorry driver in my mind, and I read these texts with that mind and see if I can help Reverend Hubert take it out of the academic and sometimes the sort of quasi-Chinese word order, because it's very difficult to translate this stuff into very fluent English right off the first time around. So I sort of help him with that aspect of things and bring up questions that arise for him to consider, which is great fun and keeps me out of mischief part of the time. So he happens to have been working on these two chapters recently and has inspired me to steal portions thereof for a Dharma talk. Well, that's what we are doing this morning. First, some aspects of what is the kesa, the Buddhist robe. I'll quote first from the chapter Kesa Kudoku. And in between times, I will do a little explanation of what I believe Reverend Dogen may be talking about. Dogen says, "Broadly speaking, we must realize that the kesa is what all Buddhas revere and devote themselves to. It is the body of Buddha. It is the mind of Buddha." Okay, why would that be? Well, the body and mind of Buddha, because it is the form of that which Buddha transmits to Buddha. And what is it that Buddha transmits to Buddha? The truth and the training. And as those of you who have studied Dogen know, Dogen will very quickly bring you to the point again and again that there is no difference between the truth and training. i.e. training and enlightenment are one. So, the Kesa, being the form of this, can be regarded as the body of Buddha, the mind of Buddha. And that is what training is. So training, your Buddhist training, is the body and mind of Buddha. It is called, says Dogen, the garment of liberation. All right, well, why would that be? We've just said, training and enlightenment are one. Therefore, that which is training is that which is enlightenment. There is no difference. It is called the robe that is a fertile field of blessings. Okay, why? Well, to me that means a fertile field of blessings because it benefits all who encounter it, whether we are speaking of the literal Kesa or the metaphorical Kesa of our training. These are of benefit to all beings. So it is a fertile field of blessings. Dogen says it is called the formless robe. Why? Because training transcends all form. He says it is called the unsurpassed robe. To me, this means that there is nothing more beautiful in its aspects, whether physical or metaphorical. There is nothing more beautiful than the training of a Buddhist. There is nothing more beautiful than that which symbolizes the training of a Buddhist. Dogen goes on. It is called the robe of patient forbearance. Again, I'll stop. Why that? Well, because it reminds us constantly of the loving kindness of the unborn. And our training brings us back again and again to what? To compassion and to loving kindness. And through those, we come to wisdom. Dogen again. It is called the robe of a Tathagata. For the robe of training is what all Buddhas wear, i.e. what all Buddhas do. It is called, says Dogen, the robe of great benevolence and great compassion. We've just spoken of that. It is called the robe that is the banner of victory. Okay, why that? Why a banner of victory? Because it builds faith. The forms of training build faith. The doing of training builds faith. And because this training is true, it is an assurance of victory. Therefore, we call the robe the banner of victory, and the training the banner of victory. It is called, says Dogen, the robe of supreme, fully perfected enlightenment. Why? You said this just before. For that is what Buddhist training is. There is not a hair's breadth of difference between training and enlightenment. It's one of the most revolutionary and far-reaching teachings of Reverend Dogen. Truly, he says, in these ways, we should accept it, keep to it, and humbly raise it above our heads. Interesting three things to do with a Kesa and a training. Accept it, keep to it, and humbly raise it above our heads. Accept it, yes. Training and the forms of training and the Kesa itself, literally, are things which must be accepted. We must accept them and take them upon ourselves. These are not things that can be imposed by anyone or anything. Keep to it. Now, the first time I encountered this, I called in Reverend Hubert and I said, what in the world do you mean by keeping to a Kesa? It's an awfully odd phraseology. And he says, well, Daiswi, keep to it, you know, as you would keep to the precepts. And a little sort of penny dropped in my head. I said, oh, okay. So we aren't talking here about keeping in the sense of putting in a drawer or putting on a shelf. We are talking about far more than keeping our Kesa or our training. We are talking about keeping to, as one would to the precepts, keeping to one's training, keeping to one's Kesa, and humbly raising it above our heads. In other words, treating our training and our Kesa, the symbol of that training, with respect. For it is the robe of Buddha, it is the training of Buddha. Some more aspects of what is a kesa. Again from Kesa Kudoku chapter. The kesa is not simply a manufactured thing, nor something that spontaneously arises in nature, nor is it something that has always existed somewhere, nor something that exists nowhere. It is that which Buddhas and Buddhas alone all ultimately realize. Okay. Buddhas and Buddhas alone all ultimately realize. Well, he's saying that there's more to this training than meets the eye, friends. That we should never underestimate the merit and efficacy of our Buddhist training and of the kesa that symbolizes that training. For if it is that which Buddhas and Buddhas alone ultimately realize, then our concepts and thoughts are but poor approximations to something far greater. Never underestimate your Buddhist training. Dogen again. Be that as it may, the spiritual merits from what is realized by practitioners who accept and keep to it will undoubtedly come to full fruition and will undoubtedly take them to the ultimate. In other words, this Buddhist training of ours, being true, will have its effects. You need not doubt that. It does have its effects. Undoubtedly, it will come to fruition. What are some of the merits of the kesa and of Buddhist training? This is from another section of Kesa Kudoku. The world-honored one, in advising the monk Jnanaprabha, my pronunciation of these things is horrible, don't copy me, spoke thus. The Dharma robe, based on its material, color, and dimensions, acquires 10 superb benefits. First, because it blankets your body well, it keeps feelings of shame or embarrassment at bay and shields you with a sense of modesty so that you may train with the good Dharma and put it into practice. Now, obviously, Dogen here is not talking in the ordinary sense, because any large piece of cloth would do that. Covering, I think, in this sense, in the spiritual sense, means it covers, one covers oneself with training. When one trains honestly, with integrity, to the best of one's current ability to perceive what is wise to do, there is no cause for regret, even should we later discern that we could have done better. We simply know more and have progressed some in our training. That is no reason to regret your previous training. Second, says Dogen, because it keeps off heat and cold, as well as mosquitoes, vicious creatures, and poisonous insects, you train in the way with a feeling of peace and tranquility. Again, he can't be meaning this solely in the most literal sense, because, again, any large piece of cloth would do this. I see this as saying, in addition to the obvious literal meaning, that our training and the kesa that symbolizes it protect us from disturbing influences, i.e. vicious creatures. And why do they do that? Why does it do that? Because it is a constant reminder and a support of training and of its tradition through the ages. This Buddhist training of ours is not something that we have cooked up. This is something which has evolved and been refined for generation upon generation upon generation. The reminders that we have, both in the kesa, the Buddha image, in our various ceremonials, our various forms of ceremony, are all reminders of this tradition and of the support that lies with our training from the generations of those who have gone before. And so comes naturally from that our gratitude to the generations of Buddhists, both lay and monastic, who have gone before us. For we do not have to find this all for ourselves. In one sense, of course, you must find this for yourself. You must realize and actualize for yourself. But you don't have to start inventing the wheel, so to speak, from the beginning. People have been at this for 2,500 years. We have learned something along the way. Dogen again. Third, it makes manifest the look of one who has left home to be a monk, so that those who see you will feel delight and stay far away from wicked thoughts and feelings. Now, you will see shortly, when Dogen starts talking about the khesis being something which is pertinent to lay Buddhists as well as monks, that he can't be talking solely about monks in the literal sense here. In other words, those of you who accept a physical khesa do not worry that if you are offered a khesa, we of the monastic side of the Sangha are thinking, that one's monk meat. Okay? We want that one, you know, recruiting poster. I don't know what recruiting posters look like over on this side of the Atlantic, but on the other side, there's sort of a little, an old guy with his finger, you know, I want you for that. Right. No. Leaving home in this sense is the mind of a monk, that is to say, non-attachment. Leaving home in the sense of non-attachment. Our training is a training of learning acceptance, learning non-attachment, which can be done anywhere. There is nothing in this entire world that can stop you from doing that. You can learn all acceptance. From all acceptance comes non-attachment. And from a non-attachment, all acceptance, they work together. In any circumstance, whether it be monastic, whether it be lay. And that training, whether you appear in the form of a monk, or whether you appear in the form of a lay minister, or appear in the form of a lay Buddhist, or appear in the form of a good human being, will bring delight to those who see, and will encourage others to stay far away from wicked thoughts and feelings, as Dogen says, simply by the example that you give. It's very odd how powerful that is. Those of you who have been in Buddhist training for a long time will know what I'm speaking of. You are always teaching. Do not think that only those who wear the brocade khesa or who sit in a teacher's seat or who celebrate the ceremony are teachers. You are all teaching all the time, as are we. The only question is, what is it that you're teaching at the moment? Because people are affected by everything you do. Are they affected for the good, or are they affected towards more suffering? You have no choice, my friends. You are always teaching. The only question, as I said, is what is it that you are teaching? And your Buddhist training will cause others to feel delight and stay far away from wickedness over the long term. Now, sometimes some people say are a little bit surprised at what this Buddhism is about, and initially will have a reaction of fear from that surprise. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the long-term effects of simply going on in Buddhist training. And that is an exceedingly powerful thing which will overcome those types of superficial fears and doubts that people may have. Dogen again. Fourth, the khesa has the appearance of a veritable jeweled banner for persons of ordinary or of lofty position. Those who honor and esteem it will be able to be reborn in Brahma's heavenly realm. In other words, the appearance, the forms of our training say to those who meet us, this is a Buddhist, this is Buddhist training. Our acts say this, our speech says this, our physical appearance says this. This is Buddhist training. So therefore it is a jeweled banner to all persons. Fifth, says Dogen, when we wear a kesa, he gives rise to thoughts of a precious banner which can extinguish whatever is bedeviling sentient beings and can produce all manner of happiness and virtue. This is not magic we're talking about here. This is the offering of hope to all that there is an end to suffering. And by our doing the training, and by wearing the kesa, and by believing in our own training and doing it honestly and forthrightly, we offer hope to all sentient beings. Sixth, says Dogen, right from the beginning, when we construct a kesa, we should dye it with a loaded color, that is to say, not a pure color, not a bright primary color, thereby avoiding thoughts of greed engendered by the five senses, as well as the arousal of covetousness and lust. Now, in practice, some kesas are of a primary color, some of the ceremonial ones. But basically, what he's talking about here is that these forms of training, the kesa in particular, and others as well, are not forms done to arouse a sense of envy in others, a sense of covetousness in others. They are to produce within ourselves reminders of dispassion, not of passion, of peace, not of lusting after things. Therefore, taking the kesa for a moment on the literal level, do not long for, do not wish for, a different kesa physically than what you have. The kesa that you have as a lay Buddhist, as a lay minister, is the kesa of the Buddha. All kesas are the kesa of the Buddha. Do not long for the kesa of cold brocade. Do not long for anything other than the kesa that you have. For its intent is not to produce longing, but the opposite of longing. And if you understand it clearly, you will see that. Seventh, the kesa is the immaculate robe of the Buddha, which permanently cuts off defiling passions, because it makes them into fertile fields for good. Again, not by magic, but because that is what training does. Eighth, when you put a kesa on your body, it wears away the karma from your defiling acts and promotes moment by moment the treading of the path of good deeds done by keeping to the 10 precepts. That is to say, our training is a reminder of the 10 precepts, and our forms of training remind us of the precepts. And it is those precepts which wear away the karma, not a physical object. Ninth, the kesa also resembles a fertile field because it promotes the good and virtuous bodhisattva way. Again, as a reminder of the bodhisattva way. Tenth, the kesa also resembles armor because it is able to protect you from being harmed by the poisonous arrows of the defiling passions. Again, through training. Ojnanaprabha, you surely realize that whenever Buddhas, at any time, past, present, or future, and both Pratyeka Buddhas and Shravakas, as well as immaculate monks, put the kesa upon their body, as a result of the causal effect of these 10, i.e., the merits we just talked about, these three holy types, Buddhas, lay trainees, and monks, alike, sit upon the precious platform of liberation. Wielding the sword of wisdom, they defeat the demons of defiling passion, and these holy types, together as equals, enter the various realms of nirvana. Interesting. Buddhas, lay trainees, and monks, sitting together upon the platform of liberation, together as equals. Within the training of the Buddhas, all are equal. Akesa covers all. And together we progress in training on this platform of liberation, he speaks of. Side by side, together as equals. A very important point. Now from Den A, the other chapter, some things about when is it appropriate to wear the kesa or to accept the kesa, i.e., when is it appropriate to consider oneself a committed Buddhist, or who wears the kesa, who is a committed Buddhist? From Den A. Any householder, male or female, who can accept the Buddhist precepts should don a kesa of 5, 7, or 9 panels. How much more those who have left home to be monks? Why would we not wear one? It is said that everyone from Lord Brahma and those in the 6 realms below him down to male and female prostitutes and those into forced servitude can receive the Buddhist precepts and can don the kesa, i.e. the kesa of training. So, are there male and female monks who would not wear one? It is said that even animals can take the Buddha's precepts and can put on a kesa. So why would a disciple of Buddha not don the Buddha's robe? So this business of accepting the Buddhist precepts seems to be one of the things that is central to the kesa of training. And when we take the Buddhist precepts, we don the kesa. And that is the reason why the first kesa that one ever takes of a physical sort in Buddhism is after one formally takes the precepts at the taking of the precept ceremony. Because this taking of the precepts is the one of the essences of becoming a committed Buddhist. And anyone who takes those precepts, whether it be at that formal ceremony or not, if they take them in their heart and keep to them in their heart, they are a Buddhist. Those who would become a disciple of the Buddha, be they denizens of some heavenly state, ordinary humans, rulers of nations, government officials, be they laity, monks, those forced into servitude, or animals, should all accept the Buddha's precepts and have the kesa correctly transmitted to them. This indeed is the straight path for entering the ranks of Buddha. All right, accepting the precepts. What does this mean to accept the precepts and then don the kesa? Well, we all know what the precepts are. They're do not kill, do not steal, do not covet, etc. So you accept those, and then you're a Buddhist. Is it that simple? I wonder. Well, on one level it's pretty simple. I mean, for instance, what does do not steal mean? It means don't pinch your neighbor's car, right? Okay, we can all pretty well, I think most of us can avoid that. So we don't steal. That's pretty clear. Let's go on to the next one. Or should we? Let's stay with do not steal for a minute. Right, we aren't going to pinch our neighbor's car. What about our neighbor's copyright? Well, there's a concept. What are we going to run through our photocopier and distribute? What computer programs are we going to copy and give to our friends? What tape cassettes are we going to copy and give to our friends? Is that fair use, or is that stealing someone's copyright? Oh dear, we're going to have to make some decisions, aren't we? And it's not, there's no clear absolute rule, is there? Things differ in different situations. We're going to have to do the best we can and make ethical decisions, and we're going to have to take the consequences of those decisions. And we're going to have to become aware at a little bit deeper level of what this do not steal means. Without becoming on the one hand rigid and obsessive or on the other hand, slapdash and unaware. And by the way, whose photocopier are we using? Are we using the one at work? Well, how much personal use of our photocopier at work is part of the normal and expected fringe benefits of our job? And how much of it is taking that which is not given? And that's going to depend on the particular situation and the particular expectations of our employer. And the particular uses that we are making of these things, we are going to, I'm afraid, have to make some decisions again. So it's getting a little bit more complex, isn't it? And we're still just talking about stuff, things here. What about stealing our neighbor's privacy and peace and quiet instead of his or her copyright? Where does your right to the free use and enjoyment of your own property end, and your obligation not to interfere with your neighbor's free use and enjoyment of his or her property begin? All right. More decisions to be made. More awareness required of us. More compassion. More wise discernment. No easy rule to follow. And we take the consequences of doing the best we can. And then we could always turn around and make it a little more complicated by applying it to ourselves. What about your own awareness and your own clarity of mind and ability to perceive the truth? One can steal that from oneself. So, where does a healthy and free experiencing of your own ideas and emotions slide over into a self-indulgent emotionalism and a wallowing in your own delusions, which will steal your awareness, your oneness with truth? And conversely, where does perceptual attempts to not steal such awareness from oneself slide over on the other side into repressive self-judgment that steals the same thing in a completely different way? No rule, no formula, constant awareness, deepening awareness, turning the stream of compassion within, doing the best one can, learning from what happens, and going on straightforwardly, standing up straight, as they say, in the eyes of the Buddha. So the precepts take different forms and at different levels. There are different levels of understanding of them. There is an ever-deepening and ever-widening understanding and a becoming more subtle. There's also the question, even within our own tradition, of which form or variant of the precepts are we keeping to? Different traditions have slightly different forms and variants. In our own tradition, for instance, there are several sets of slightly different precepts. For instance, are we taking the one that emphasizes not coveting in a general way? Or are we taking the one which focuses more specifically on not being indulgent in sexuality? And by the way, what does that mean? More decisions, no formulas. Are we taking the set of precepts that emphasizes using intoxicants? Are we taking the one that emphasizes not intoxicating others? And on what level are we speaking when we speak of intoxicants and intoxicating? Just how subtle do we take intoxication to be? It's certainly more than going to the local and having a brew, or having too many brews. There are many forms of intoxication, some of which do not require ingesting any physical substance whatsoever. We can do it all inside our own little heads. with our ideas. It's for this reason that the precepts are taken again and again in Buddhist training in our tradition, to provide an avenue for reminding ourselves that they expand in this way, becoming more subtle, becoming more compassionate, widening, deepening. And so we have the opportunity to take them again and again to remind us of this. And each of these is a time of donning the kesa, sometimes in the literal way and sometimes in the figurative way. So those are some thoughts about the subtlety and the complexity of this business of keeping to the precepts and of donning the kesa. And we go back to Kesa Kodoku for another aspect of when do we take the kesa, when do we take the training upon ourselves. Dogen again. That laity, be they commoners or those in lofty positions, accept and keep to the kesa is the best key to the greater course. Both Lord Brahma and Lord Chakra have now accepted and kept to the kesa, and are excellent models in the realm of sense desire and in the realm of form. And among humans, the number of excellent examples cannot be calculated. Lay bodhisattvas have all accepted and keep to it. Lay bodhisattvas. Yes. The taking of the kesa, the accepting, the keeping to the kesa, has something to do then with the bodhisattva way. The putting aside of selfishness and the training for both self and other, i.e. for the benefit of all beings. This is our training. This is our taking of the kesa. And this is done by the laity and the monks. And those who do this are bodhisattvas, manifestations, embodiments of love and compassion, and through them of wisdom. Dogen again. In China, both Emperor Wu of the Liang Dynasty and Emperor Yang of the Sui Dynasty accepted and kept to the kesa. Both Emperor Taizong and Emperor Suzong of the Tang Dynasty wore the kesa. They trained and studied amongst the monastic family, as well as accepted and kept to the bodhisattva precepts. Other folks, such as lay disciples and their wives, who have accepted the kesa and taken the precepts, have been excellent models in past and in present. A couple of interesting points here. They have trained and studied amidst the monastic family, i.e., together. This training is something that we do together, and it is something wherein we accept guidance and take refuge. And we take refuge within the Sangha family, of which the monastic family is a part, and the Sangha family generally is the larger part. And so there is time for a committed Buddhist to train and study with the monks together as part of the family, the monastic family, and the Sangha family. And those who do this and keep to the bodhisattva precepts are excellent models in both past and future. How are they excellent models? This goes back to what I was speaking of before. You are a model at all moments, for good or for ill. You are teaching. You are a model. Now some aspects of how to accept and keep to the kesa, i.e. the Buddhist training. Back to Kesa Kodoku again. True, we have been born in a remote land, exposed to its dharma in the final days, sad to say. Okay, this was right, how many years ago, 700 years ago? Okay. But even so, in that we have encountered the robe and the teaching as received by Buddha after Buddha for generation after generation, what greater joy could there be? So we keep to our training and its form, the kesa, we keep to it with joy. That is one aspect. Back to Dogen. Which other tradition has correctly transmitted both the robe and the Dharma of the Venerable Shakyamuni as we have straightforwardly transmitted them? Even if in the space of a single day we were to renounce our physical life for time as countless as the sands of the Ganges, we should still humbly make offerings to both robe and Dharma. This is something else. Making of offerings. What is the highest of offerings? The offering of our Buddhist training. Forgotten what scripture says that, but they said one lovely one which says it is the offering of our Buddhist training that we bring to the begging bowl this day. So we make offerings, again, in the literal sense and in the figurative, metaphorical sense. And the highest of all offerings is the offering of doing our Buddhist training. Indeed, says Dogen, we should vow that upon encountering them in life after life, for generation after generation, we will humbly raise them above our head, make offerings to them, and venerate them. Life after life and generation after generation. This is not a short-time business, my friends. This is a long-term commitment. For as long as may be good. That's how long. For as long as may be good. We cannot know that. We must be willing to put one foot in front of the next, always becoming Buddha, for as long as may be good. Dogen again. Even though we are separated from the Buddha's native land by more than 100,000 leagues of mountains and seas too difficult to traverse, nevertheless, spurred on by our good deeds in some past life, these mountains and seas do not stand as obstacles blocking our way, nor have we ever been dismissed and shunned as muddle-headed, ignorant provincials. Having respectfully encountered this genuine teaching, we put it into practice day and night to the best of our ability. Keeping to this kesa, which we have respectfully accepted, we guard it and protect it, constantly taking joy in it. Now there's a sentence for you. Having respectfully encountered this genuine teaching, we do what? Put it into practice day and night, right? This is not a part-time thing. To what? To the best of our ability. What more can be asked of us than the best of our ability as we perceive that at the moment? Nothing more is asked of you than that. No ideal standard of perfection. What is asked of us by the Buddhas and ancestors is to do the best we can as we understand that and as we are able at the moment. Keeping to this kesa which we have respectfully accepted, we both respected our Buddhist training, we respected not our selfish aspect, but our true self. We have respected that which trains and not disrespected anything. One does not disrespect even the selfish aspects of oneself, even though one trains with them and does something about them. One does so with respect. We guard and protect, right, both literally and figuratively. We guard and protect our training and our form of training. Not that such things can be taken away from us, but we guard and protect from our own internal, our own unwillingnesses that arise from time to time. The external things can make training more difficult or less difficult. They cannot stop you. The only thing that can stop you in your Buddhist training is you. So we guard and protect. Again, not with a heavy-handed way, but with gentleness and compassion, and at the same time with energy and vigor and honesty. And finally, the last clause, constantly taking joy in it. This is a joyful thing. This is not a training that will end up having you look like a pitted prune or a sour plum. The training is a training that is joyful. You are not always happy. The truth does not always make you happy. Sometimes it makes you sad. But beneath all of that and within all of that, there is a joy. Dogen goes on, how could this possibly be due to the cultivation of spiritual merits under the tutelage of just one or two of the Buddhas? It must be due wholly to the cultivation of all kinds of spiritual merits under the tutelage of Buddhas more numerous as the sands of the Ganges. Even if it were due to our own efforts, we should still feel respect for the robe and the Dharma and should enjoy heartfelt gratitude. Gratitude. Yes. This is one of the hallmarks of our particular tradition. Gratitude to the Buddhas, gratitude to the Dharma, gratitude to each other, the Sangha. We should cordially, says Dogen, show our gratitude to the ancestral masters for their profound kindness in transmitting the Dharma to us. This is why every morning in a Buddhist, in the temple of our tradition, we recite the ancestral line and offer incense at the altar of the founders. Continuing from Kesa Kodoku. The lay and monastic bodhisattvas who have accepted and keep to the Kesa are many, for which I rejoice. These companions who have accepted and kept to the Kesa, nice wording, companions. We are in training companions, whether we wear the Wagesa, the small Kesa, the large Kesa, the monk or the lay minister, or the Kesa of gold brocade, we are companions and must be companions to one another. These companions who have accepted and kept to the Kesa should, without fail, humbly raise the Kesa above their head each morning and evening, i.e. give reverence to the training and to the forms of it. And so if you have a physical Kesa each morning before your home altar, raise it above your head and recite the Kesa verse as a part of what you may wish to do. And this is something I recommend to you, to add, if you are not already doing that, to your Buddhist training. It takes but a moment, but it has implications that are wide and wide-ranging. And again, in the evening, just for a moment, you don't recite the Kesa verse again necessarily, but you just place the Kesa upon your head morning and evening as a time of reverence to your training and your commitment to training. Dogen again, for the spiritual merits of this will be unsurpassed. The reading or hearing a single line from scripture or the whole of the Kesa verse, that's what we recite in the morning, the Kesa, should not be confined to what I saw or heard everywhere throughout the highways and byways of China, where such things were as common as trees and stones. In other words, don't let this practice become something that is confined just to what was done in the old days or what is done by the monks. Let this practice be available to us all. And he concludes, even if the spiritual merits from the genuine transmission of the Kesa were encountered for a scant day and night, they would be preeminent and unsurpassed. Goes back to what we said earlier, never, never underestimate the merit and the efficacy of your own Buddhist training. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dhamma, homage to the Sangha.